Some Sundays I feel like I want to preach to you and I speak to you from up there. This morning, though, I want to talk to you friend to friend because I want to deal with something that's difficult and something that you often have conversations about with your friends about God. Grandfathers and granddaughters share this special bond. I know I do with our two granddaughters. And part of it has to do with the fact that my jokes are just so good, and they really like my jokes, the grandfather jokes. They're even better than daddy jokes. And the other thing is that we're a little mischievous together. And when Debbie and I first got our nice, decent car that was new enough that it no longer had a cassette deck, it actually had a CD player. Along with that car also came this really fun little clicker thing that I had a lot of fun with. You could unlock your door at a distance. You could make it beep at a distance. And we played this game on Sunday morning, Leora, our oldest, our firstborn granddaughter and I, when we would leave church on Sunday morning and we were attending church at St. Andrew and St. Paul and then at St. Lambert, and we would park on the side streets downtown. And as we left church every day, there's this game we played, looking for the car. And I told my granddaughter that we had a magical car, that if we called out to the car would call back. So with one hand firmly in my pocket, we would walk down the side streets around St. Andrew and St. Paul going, car, car, and the car would go beep, 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 until we found the car. Now, this worked really well until Leora got to be 7 or 8 and 9, and then the game was up. And when our second granddaughter was born, when she was old enough to walk and to be looking for the car, we played the same game until one day the older granddaughter said, "Don't be silly, the car doesn't talk. Grandpa's got a clicker in his pocket and he's playing a joke on you." Some people feel that God is a little bit like that magical explanation for the car that beeps at a distance. There's a feeling for many that our early ancestors one day were sitting around the campfire tens of thousands of years ago, and there was bright lightning and thunder in the sky. They didn't know how it happened. They couldn't explain it. And they said, well, it must be some creature in the sky who's powerful and who does this. And over time, developed what we have called the theory of the God of the gaps. The God of the gaps. And God was what we used to explain all of those gaps in our understanding. When we didn't know why the corn crops failed, well, it must be God. We didn't pray hard enough. When we didn't understand why there was an earthquake, well, God decided there was an earthquake. When we didn't understand why a child would die in an early age in an accident, it was, well, God was just the way we explained the things we couldn't explain. But fortunately for us, science has developed now, and we've filled in almost all the gaps. And there's not a lot of things we can't explain anymore. And, well, humanity, kind of like our granddaughters who understood the way the car clicker worked, humanity, we're now mature enough, we don't need all of these magical explanations anymore. And so we don't really need God. And so when you talk to your friends about the power and the might of the God that you worship, for some of them, the reaction is, oh, how cute that is. You know, that's an old tradition, like going to, you know, Christmas Mass, like getting a new hat on Easter Sunday morning, you know, like all these little traditions that we have. And one of these little quaint, cute, old traditions we used to have was about this big, powerful being called God that we used to explain all the things that we can't explain. I'm sure you've heard that. So how do we respond? How do we respond to people around us who say, God used to be a nice idea, we really needed it for a while, but not anymore, we've moved beyond that? Well, I have to say that our first response as believers is that we have to accept some responsibility for people thinking this way. Because for many, many decades, we are the ones who have begun to treat God as the God of the gaps. for many years, as I have heard people defending the existence of God, they've defended him. Well, you know, we don't know how we came from and how evolution happened. It must be God. We don't know how this happened, and that must be God. And so for many years as Christians, we've had these discussions and these debates with scientists, and we kept saying, well, you know, that stuff you can't explain, well, that's God. And the problem is that the next week they figure out how to explain it, and that's not God anymore. So you figure, well, something else. Well, that other thing you can't explain, that's God. And then the next month, they figure out how to explain that. And you gradually, you recess and you recess and you recess. I've had fun over the last little bit. I've been helping some friends of mine put ceramic tile on their patio, on their balcony. And a balcony's not very big. I've had ceramic tile in kitchen floors and in bathrooms and in living rooms before. But it's a new challenge to lay ceramic tile in a balcony because the balcony's not very big. And you start tiling, and we got to the point, my friend and I, where the two of us were standing on a very small piece of balcony that wasn't tiled yet, trying not to step on the fresh tiles, and we kind of cornered ourselves. And unfortunately, as Christian believers, this is what we have done in our discussions about God. We kept telling people around us that God is what we use to explain what we can't explain. And now that there's fewer and fewer and fewer and fewer things that we can't explain anymore, we've narrowed God to this tiny little space, and he's become inconsequential to most people. And unfortunately, we've done that with a lot of things. I get into conversations with a lot of my friends about what is called the young earth theory. And in 1650, there was an Anglican bishop, very well-meaning gentleman, but he took the Bible and he added all of the genealogies together in the Old Testament. And he added all of the years that Abraham and Moses and Adam lived. And he calculated back, assuming that the Bible tells us everything, which is a very, very risky presupposition. But Bishop Usher actually calculated that if you calculate all of this together, it means that the earth was created in 4004 B.C., on the 23rd of October, a little bit before 10 a.m. Well, for several hundred years, that worked okay. And many Christians stake their faith on the fact that the earth has to be 6,022 years old and 3 months and 2 weeks and 4 days and 17 hours. Well, the problem is that when we started to leave Europe, we got to China, and we discovered that the Chinese have banking records that go back 10,000 years. You know, when you go to the machine and you put your bank book in and you update your bank book to see how far in the red you are, you know when you do that? Well, the Chinese have been keeping records this way, and they have written banking records of who owed who how much money back over 10,000 years. And the Mayans, just to the south of us in South America, they've been keeping track on a calendar, and their calendar has been tracking for over 12,000 years. You know, if you have a calendar at home, you rip off a page every day. Well, they've been ripping a page off every day for 12,000 years. And we suddenly had a problem. And Christians became very, very red-faced because they had insisted for many, many years that if you believe in God, you must believe that the earth is only 6,000 years old. But we have 10,000 years of Chinese banking records, and we have 12,000 years of Mayan calendars. And we are the ones who have painted God into this narrow little corner. And for many people around us, he has become inconsequential. Now, I've got to tell you, some of the latest scientific work is very, very startling as far as what it tells us about our understanding of where we come from. I've had great fun reading about the Human Genome Project because it has messed absolutely everything up in terms of evolutionary thinking. Since the publication of Darwin's On the Origin of Species, we had a fairly good understanding of what Darwin thought the way all of this should work out. And the difficulty we've had now, as we look at our DNA, we realize that our DNA is mixed up all over this tree. The tree was nice and orderly. We knew where we came from. We knew where our ancestors came from. But, you know, I got to tell you, it's very interesting to me that as my sister is facing open-heart surgery tomorrow, and they're looking at replacing a piece of valve, and they look for an animal that has a DNA as close as possible to human beings so that she doesn't reject that piece of valve. And I need to tell you, they're not looking at taking a piece of valve from a chimpanzee, a monkey, or a gorilla. They want to take a piece of valve from a pig, because the pig is the animal that has the closest DNA to us. Who thought, right, Darwin would be turning over in his grave? as we've done the Human Genome Project. You know, if you watch on TV, there's these places you can spit on a stick, put it in an envelope, and then send them to them, and then they'll come back and tell you, you know, you're 3% Korean, 8% Swahili, and 16%, you know, and they do all of this for you, right? Well, as we've done this work, it's created problems for our evolutionary understanding, because as we look at all of the DNA, and particularly we work with the mitochondrial DNA, this is the DNA of the female of the species that a female passes on to her offspring directly without impact as much from the male's DNA. That's a dramatic oversimplification. I'm sorry for the oversimplification, but that's as much as we've got time for this morning. But as we look at the human genome, and as we look at the DNA link, the difficulty we've got now is that if we look at the DNA of the 7 billion people who are alive on the Earth today, and we trace it back to see how far back all of this DNA traces back to one person, well, if you're a literalist, there's a problem. It's not 6,000 years, but if you're an evolutionary, you've got a problem, because all of this traces us back to no more than about 100,000 years ago, somewhere less than 100,000 years ago, somewhere in Northeast Africa. Our DNA is now telling us that all 7 billion of us came from one couple less than 100,000 years ago, somewhere in Northeastern Africa. And there are scientists who are now busy rewriting all kinds of textbooks, because this clashes with what we've thought about histories of billions of years for a long time. So the jury is still out. And you've got to be careful when you try to take God and push him into the current scientific understanding. Because I can guarantee you that what science says today will be improved and new and better next week, and some of the numbers will change. So when people challenge us about this God of the gaps, we need to first admit responsibility. We have painted ourselves into a corner, and we need not to do that. And the second thing we need to do is that we need to take a step back and ask some larger questions about God with a wider perspective. First of all, with a wider time perspective. It's really funny to me that in the scriptures, only once in the New Testament does it talk about what we believe, what our faith tells us about the origin of the world. In Hebrews chapter 11, the writer talks to us about our faith and what we believe about the might and the power of God. And he doesn't mention 6 days. He doesn't mention 6,000 years. He just brings up one thing. Listen to what he says. By faith, we understand that the universe was created by the word of God, so that what is seen was not made out of things that are visible. What is seen was not made out of things that are visible. As believers, there's one thing we know that science will never explain. Why is there something instead of nothing? How, at some point, did we go from nothing exists to suddenly everything is there? Scriptures tell us it is by the power of the Word of God. The story goes that scientists had gotten together, and they'd managed to solve everything. And they got to the point where they could actually take raw material and create life in a lab. They've actually done this, some elementary forms of life. And so they approach God and they say, God, you can retire now. We're the leading scientists of the world. We've figured out how to do everything. We can even create life. We don't need you anymore. You can retire, move to Jamaica or Barbados, wherever you want to go, and take it easy, because we've got this under control. God says, okay, I'll tell you what. Let's have a contest. We'll make a living creature-making contest. We'll both make a living creature from scratch, and we'll see who does it best. Scientists say, fine, you're on. So the scientists go over to their lab. They bend over. They pick up a bunch of dirt. They put it on their test. And God says, no, 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 no. That's my dirt. You make your own dirt. We want a wider perspective on time, but also a wider perspective that's not so much about the how or about the when, but about the why. And we get tripped up about the how. And I want to readjust your expectations for a second. If you've ever looked at the book of Genesis, From Genesis 37 to Genesis 50, 14 chapters, in slow, painstaking details, God tells us about the life of one man, Joseph. Genesis takes 14 chapters to give us a blow-by-blow, detailed description of the life of Joseph. And it takes God half a verse to create the universe. Genesis gives us two chapters on the origins of the entire universe, the Milky Way galaxy, the whole thing. God does it in less than two chapters, in fact. And there's 14 chapters about the life of Joseph. Genesis is not a very good biology textbook. If you're looking for a biology textbook, Genesis doesn't have a lot of details, but it has a lot to say about philosophy and about theology. Because the Word of God wants to talk to us about who and about why more than it wants to talk to us about how. Now, the first challenge to the power of God reduces him to this cute, quaint, old tradition like Father Christmas. It was a nice idea, you know, we think about it Christmas and Easter and the rest of the year, just kind of leave us alone. It's, you know. But there are people, when you talk to them about the power of God, they get a little more defensive because they take issue. The second response to the power of God suggests that he's a cruel tyrant and he shouldn't exist. And in fact, the second objection that is much stronger remembers what we talked about 2 weeks ago. We said that God was all loving. And this morning we're suggesting to you that God is all powerful, and they have a problem with putting those two things together. Because if God is all loving and God is all powerful, then how come bad stuff happens? There's only two possibilities, they think. If God's love is unlimited, as we claimed 2 weeks ago, and his power is unlimited, as we're claiming this morning, and bad stuff happens, there's only one of two possibilities. Either he doesn't want to stop the bad things from happening, and then he's not as loving as we think, or he wants to stop them, and he can't, and then he's not as powerful as we claim. And so which is it? How can God be all-loving and all-powerful at the same time, and yet I can't get my car started on Monday morning? Three responses. We need to begin by putting evil in perspective. We need to admit to ourselves that we live in a world where there is an overabundance of good and pleasant and positive things that happen. Billions of babies are born on time, healthy, breathing, with 10 toes, 10 fingers, working brains, and go on to have perfectly healthy, normal lives. There's a bad hurricane in the States right now. But there have been hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of days with no hurricanes. There's a couple places in the world where there's a lot of war going on. But there are dozens of countries in the world that live in relative peace and security as we do. And if you know human nature the way I do from pastoring, you know how much of a miracle that is. Why is it that when a day goes off perfectly well without a hitch, we don't give God the credit? But when something goes wrong, we want to blame him. You can't have it both ways. If God is responsible for the hurricane, he's responsible for the beautiful sunny day. If God is responsible for the handicapped child who was born, he's responsible for the billions of babies who are born perfectly healthy. You can't play it both ways. There is a wonder of the delicate balance of the planet we live on that we take for granted. Our axis is tilted just a little bit. Because the axis of our planet is tilted just a little bit, and you got to know, of all the planets we've discovered, almost none of them have a tilted axis. So what? Well, the tilted axis means we have seasons. Because we have seasons, it means that agriculture works the way it does. Because in most regions of the world, we do agriculture 8-9 months a year, and during 2-3 months of the year, we have to give the planet a rest. And that allows us to grow as well as we do. Because of the seasons, there's migration of animals that brings us the wonder that we have. Because our planet exists in this very, very narrow range of temperature, it means we have liquid water on our planet. That makes huge difference for us. Life is possible because water is liquid, as you can tell if you watch me spit on a Sunday morning when I preach. I'm sorry. And the very fact that we have this innate sense that when something goes wrong, something is wrong, is an indication that we know that something is up. If there had never been a God, if there was no God, if we were an accident of nature, if it was just the wild dog-eat-dog world, who cares about the hurricanes? Who cares about handicapped children? They're weak. Let them die. It doesn't matter. Survival of the fittest. But that's not the way we feel. There is something innately deep down within us that wants to care for those who are weak and sick. There is something inside of us that sees a tragedy and that responds with empathy and care and says this shouldn't have happened. And this is there because there is a spark of God and eternity that is still in our hearts and our souls that says that there is an order, that there is a way that things should be, and when they run wrong, we try to fix it, we want it to be fixed, and we want it to be right. The second perspective we need to remember about evil is this, and this surprises some people. I tell people that the existence of evil is actually a proof of the existence of God and of something deeper than what we are. When I argue with people, when I defend with them why I believe in God, I tell them two things. I have what I call the argument from absolute stupidity. The argument from absolute stupidity is about the church. And I tell them that over the last 2,000 years, the church has made every stupid, boneheaded decision you can imagine, and you know what? We're still here. That is nothing short of miraculous. If any company out there had made half the mistakes the church has made over the last 2,000 years, they would have been wiped off, removed from the New York Stock Exchange, and disappeared eons ago. After all the persecutions, all the stupidities, all of the mistakes, all the crazy stunts we've pulled, the church is still here. And then I talk to them about the argument from absolute evil. There is some evil I can explain in natural causes. Sometimes wars happen because one country wants more money or wants more territory or wants something. But there is evil that happens in the world that has no possible explanation. For over 4,000 years, hatred and vileness and persecution has been unfurled against this tiny little country in the Middle East called Israel, and repeatedly countries have tried to wipe it off the map for no absolute reason. They are insignificant. They have a tiny piece of land. They don't hold the balance of power. They're insignificant and unimportant to anybody. And time and time and time again, people after people, tyrant after tyrant, have tried to wipe out this little country. There's no absolute, absolutely no possible human explanation except this, that she plays a role in God's plan and the devil wants to undo it, and that's it. You have all been confronted and seen moments of evil that is so terrible, so over the top, so unbelievable that there's absolutely no explanation for it other than the fact that there's something going on beyond our human rational world. There are forces at work beyond us that create and generate evil that we cannot explain. The existence of absolute evil suggests that there is more than our physical world. There's a deeper reality going on beyond us. And then finally, there's what I call the explicable evil. So much of the evil we see in the world is unfortunately explicable. Three little letters, and it's got I right in the middle of it, and sin. And we look at histories of entire countries that were affected by sin, by the depravity of man, and the results. And we look at human lives that are destroyed and paralyzed because of human sin. One of the foster children that we had who came to us when he was 3 months old had severe asthma when he was born, could barely breathe, and his mother chain-smoked 2 packs a day through 9 months of pregnancy. And surprise, surprise, her baby was born with asthma. And so the question then becomes, well, if these bad things happen because people do bad things, then why doesn't God intervene? Why doesn't God stop it? I agree. When people do stupid things, God should stop them. On the way home this afternoon, as you're on the Metropolitan, and the posted speed limit is 70, when you're going 71, God should stop. Oh, no, not, you know, not the big stuff is what I mean. See, and that's the problem. When we say that we'd like God to intervene and stop when the bad stuff happens, we don't mean me. We don't mean when I cheat on my taxes, or when I go over the speed limit, or when I cheat on my wife, or when I... We mean, no, the other guy, when he does the really bad stuff. That's when... Those of you who follow the news, we've been talking about how severe the repercussions should be to people who text while they drive. There is a young girl who's in the hospital now, and in the hospital they served her with her third conviction for texting and driving. This is the second accident she's caused because of texting and driving. And she isn't going to walk again. She's in a wheelchair, paralyzed from the chest down, because she was texting and driving one too many times. Where does God stop? When does he step in? When does he save us from our foolishness? And ultimately, that's what we want. We want God to stop other people's evil, but to let us live the lives that we want to live. I have these silly objections sometimes that people ask me when I talk to them about the power of God. And my favorite silly question is this one. Yeah, you think God can do anything? Well, can God make a rock big enough so that even he can't lift it? And when people ask me that one, I like to say, okay, can you draw me a circle that's square? There are things that God cannot do. There are things that God cannot do because they are against his nature. Did you know that? There's things that God cannot do. Let me give you one example. In the book of Hebrews, Hebrews chapter 6, it talks about the way God has made promises and covenants to us. And listen to this. One of the things God cannot do, it says, and the writer of Hebrews says, relax. God's taking care of you. He's made some promises. They're going to come true. You're going to be okay. And listen to what he says. God did this so that by two unchangeable things in which it is impossible for God to lie. Did you get that? God is all-powerful, almighty, can do anything he wants. He's the boss. He's supreme. But you know what? It is impossible for God to lie. And some of you are thinking, hey, God, I could give you a lesson. I lie all the time. So let me show you how it's done. This is how you... It's not that God doesn't understand how to lie. It's that God can't, because it's against his nature. And when we get to know God, we realize this. God is not a bully. God could step in today and stop all the speeding on the Metropolitan, stop all the pregnant women from smoking and drinking in their pregnancy, because he could step in and stop all of this. I hate to tell you, though, it would not be a pleasant day. A lot of stuff would come to an end all of a sudden. God does not want a forced relationship with us. And the only way this would work out is if God created us and gave us the freedom to choose him. As I do pastoral counseling and I prepare couples for weddings, and I work with couples after they're married and they realize it's not working, one of the hardest things I confront in my office is the jealous, overbearing, controlling, usually it's the husband. And this is not who God is. God doesn't want to force us into relationship with him. He's wooing us. He's courting us. Now, make no mistake. God will eventually bring every evil to judgment. That's one of the reasons why the two texts that we read this morning about God's power, there was the God at the beginning who created the world, and there's the God at the end who will say, that's it, time has ended, and now it's time to give account. And I'm sorry, it uses a bad word. I think it might be the first time in church that you heard the word prostitute. But there it is. And I don't think that refers to a single person. There have been a lot of tyrants who have brought an awful lot of pain and immorality and corruption to this world. And they're all referred to under that one title. One day God will bring everything to judgment and he will right all of the wrongs of history. One of the reasons why I believe in the resurrection and eternity is that for Hitler's, Idi Amin's, the King Leopold's of this world, one life is not enough to pay for what they have done. And so we believe in a God of judgment who enter eternity. Eternity will bring repercussions and judgment to the actions of individuals. And this gives us hope as we continue to work. God will bring these things into judgment, but not yet. these are the days of God's patience, and he is wooing you, he is courting you, he wants a relationship. He wants a relationship with you that you want, not that you are forced into. One day, the wind and the rain and the sun got into an argument. And they began to argue about which one of the three was the strongest and the most powerful. And the wind thought he was the greatest. He said, I'll prove to you how great and strong and powerful I am. He says, you see that guy down there? He's riding on horseback. He's heading back to his village. Watch this. I'm going to rip that coat right off his back. And the wind blew. And you know what the guy did? He just buttoned up his coat. And the wind blew harder, and he hung on to his coat. And the wind blew even harder, and the guy took his scarf and tied it around his coat so he wouldn't lose his coat, and he hung on even tighter. And the rain said, you can't do this. Let me have a try. And the rain pelted him and pelted him in one direction, and the coat was whipping off him and getting wet and getting heavy and whipping the other way. And the guy just pulled the coat around him and tucked it under his legs on his horse not to get wet. And the rain tried his best and rained hard and was driving sideways. And the harder the rain came, the guy just hung on to the coat even stronger. And the sun said, watch this. And the wind stopped. And the rain stopped. And the sun came out, and the rain began to dry, and it started to get warm, and it got hotter and hotter, and the guy took his scarf off, and it got even hotter, and the guy unbuttoned his coat, and soon it was so hot and so sunny, the guy took his coat off. God is powerful and mighty. He could rip the coat right off your back. But God woos you by the warmth of his presence. He wants a relationship with you that is your choice, and he gives you that freedom now. This is the power of our Almighty God. He owns the world that he spoke into existence with the Word. He will eventually bring evil to judgment and restore righteousness and peace. But now, today, this Almighty and all-loving God is wooing you and drawing you in, pulling you into his unbounded love and overabundant grace. This is our God, all loving and almighty. Amen.